Seems like interest in the Civil War never really wanes, and it's really not that surprising since it was such a fascinating and critical period in our country's history. I'm thinking this morning, I was trying to recall, I probably have 100 books on the Civil War in my library at home. And among those books, a couple written by our guest today, one of Wisconsin's best and most successful authors, has a new book, a new look, and a different perspective on that area and that era. Jennifer Cheverini is a New York Times bestselling Wisconsin author, and she's especially known, I think, for her Elm Creek quilt series. But her most recent novel is a standalone historical tale. It's a real nail biter, I'll tell you that. It's called The Spy Mistress. Always glad to have her come by to talk with us about her work. And Jennifer, great to see you again.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Your previous book we talked about, too, when you were last here, was Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker. That was a standalone historical novel. And now you've followed up with the Spy Mistress, which is another Civil War novel. What's drawing you to these types of novels and that historical period?
Well, I've always been fascinated by American history, especially women's roles in American history. And I think part of that's because we don't hear a lot about what the women were doing, what people on the home front were doing. And when I was researching an earlier historical novel within the Elm Creek Quilt series, I came to the idea of, I discovered Elizabeth Keckley from Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker by researching quilts of that era. And I heard about this beautiful quilt that allegedly had been made by this African-American former slave who went on to become the most renowned dressmaker in Washington City during the Civil War. And after doing that, I thought that she should have a book of her own too, and so I wrote Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker about her. And similarly, while I was doing research for an earlier novel, I had a character in one of my historical novels that was a regimental surgeon, and he was captured at Gettysburg. And when I was trying to figure out the plot line for that character, Jonathan, we needed to find out where he would have been taken if he were captured at Gettysburg. And as I was tracing the possibilities, all of the roads led to an infamous prison in Richmond, Virginia, the Confederate capital, called Libby Prison. Yeah. Unfortunately, it was unfortunately for Mr. Libby, his name was on the door when the warehouse was converted to a prison. So his name is associated with this notorious place, even though he had nothing to do with the way the prisoners were treated there. And when I was reading more about Libby Prison, all of the accounts that I read, whether they were secondary sources written in the contemporary time, or especially accounts and memoirs written by prisoners who were held within that place, they all referred to this Miss Van Loo, this 40-something spinster of the local aristocracy who brought them food, smuggled in money for bribes, helped to arrange their escapes. And the more I read about this woman, the more I thought that, wow, she really should have a book of her own. Her story should be told. So I did include her in a chapter of that earlier book. But even back then, years ago, I knew that someday I was going to have to really delve into her history and her motivation and find out what made her become, even though she was a native of Richmond, Virginia, she was a proud Virginian. She was very proud of her state. What made her remain loyal to the Union, and not only remain loyal, but take such extraordinary risks to help the Union Army and Union prisoners of war when all around her, everyone else was going the other way?
Yeah, it was a fascinating. And she was actually posthumously inducted into the Military Intelligence Hall of Fame, as you report.
That's absolutely true. And that was something that happened in more recent years. But even after the war, General Grant publicly stated and included in his writings, too, that she was responsible for the best intelligence he got out of the Confederate capital during the war. And other General Butler for the Union and other people along the line who benefited from the information attested to her wonderful contributions as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And as I said, a real nail biter. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. I mean, she risked everything.
She really did. When at first she was able to use her gender and her social status as sort of a protection, because thanks, I suppose, if that's the proper term, thanks to the sexist, classist ideas of the time, it was simply unfathomable that a woman of the slaveholding elite of Richmond, Virginia, would side with the Union. In fact, it was very important to the PR of the time and of the city to believe that the women were staunchly with the Confederacy. And that certainly wasn't true in all cases. But she did take incredible risks. She spent her fortune on bribes and on provisions and on things for the Union prisoners of war and to help establish her network. She had a network of not only Union loyalists, but also people in very important positions within Confederate government offices who responded not so much to the Union cause, but to Union greenbacks, and were able to supply her with information she needed.
Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, she is the author of many books. Her latest is titled The Mistress. It's a wonderful book about a woman by the name of Elizabeth Van Loo, who risked everything to be a spy for the Union during the Civil War. You may be a fan of the Civil War writings, maybe a fan of Jennifer's books. Do you have a favorite? Have you heard of Elizabeth Van Loo before today's show? I had not heard of her until I picked up Jennifer's book, to be perfectly honest. You may not have either. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. Or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. And I think one of the more interesting parts of the book, or aspects of the book, I guess we could say, is how within a single family there could be staunch Unionists and also fierce Confederates.
That's absolutely true, and it wasn't just within the Van Loo family. We hear a lot about how the Civil War pit brother against brother, and that was certainly true. Within Elizabeth Van Loo's family, her mother and her brother were supportive of her efforts. They encouraged her and supported her as they could. Elizabeth tried to keep her mother out of it as the war went on, because she was very concerned that her mother, first of all, her mother was elderly and had some health issues. And also there were new laws passed to try to crack down on Richmond's loyalists. And so Elizabeth was very concerned that her efforts, her mother might be implicated in her own efforts, and then her house might be taken away. All of her fortune might be confiscated by the government. So Elizabeth did try to separate herself, her activities, from her mother as the war went on. One area where it was more difficult to disentangle herself was with her sister-in-law.
Yeah.
Her brother John was married to a woman who had very strong Confederate leanings. And later on in the war, she actually turned Elizabeth in to the authorities, and she reported Elizabeth. Part of it had to do with some estrangement from her husband and questions about child custody. So there was a little bit of personal revenge involved in that. But some of Elizabeth's cousins were serving in the Confederate Army, and so she was very torn, because she loved her family members, of course, maybe not her sister-in-law so much, but definitely her cousins. And it was difficult to be able to carry on her clandestine activities, support the Union, which she was staunchly loyal to, without letting her Confederate relatives know what she was up to, and of course without jeopardizing and putting into danger her mother and her brother.
It was amazing to me that she could go that long. I mean, to survive again and again back to that prison.
Right. Well, it was challenging, and sometimes a little money had to grease the wheels to keep her freedom. She was turned in and reported not only by her sister-in-law later in the war, but neighbors would complain about, you know, why the Van Loo women weren't getting together to knit socks for the Confederate soldiers like everyone else. And her house was put under surveillance. And newspaper articles were written. Her name was left out of it, but very pointed articles that would make, really, although her name wasn't mentioned, there was no mistake when they talked about two ladies of Church Hill who seemed to be loyal to the Union. So it was very frightening, and it was very frightening to her. She was brave. She was not fearless. She had a lot to fear. I say she was brave because she persisted despite the very real danger. Loyalists were, their houses were routinely raided. They were thrown into prisons every bit as terrible as Libby Prison. Castle Godwin was a terrible prison for loyalists. Castle Thunder, which had a very ominous name meant to put fear into the hearts of loyalists. So every day she carried food into Libby Prison. Every time she went to Confederate headquarters and asked to be allowed to take blankets and food and provisions to the enlisted men being held captive on Belle Isle out in the middle of the turbulent river, every time she did anything like this, she put her own freedom, liberty, and even her own very life in danger. But she persisted nonetheless.
Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, author of The Spy Mistress, talking with her about her novel set in the Civil War era. I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Robin Cherry, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest Jennifer Cheverini, author of many books, including her latest titled The Spy Mistress. Great to have her along. Again, you can join in with your questions or comments as we talk with her. Are you a fan of her books? Have you read the earlier book of Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker? Maybe a comment on that. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or comment there. And the book, by the way, comes out tomorrow, right?
Tomorrow's the big day.
So you'll be on the road?
I'll be starting with a visit to the Westown Barnes & Noble here in Madison, and then the very next day I'll be hitting the road. And next week I'll also have a few more stops in Wisconsin, one in Baraboo and one out in Milwaukee.
Okay, cool. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. One of the, I think, fascinating things about your book is that the fact that you had Unionists right there in the Confederate capital. And you wonder why they just didn't head north.
Well, a lot of them did. And similarly, a lot of Southern sympathizers in the north headed south. We have this idea, I think, that everyone in the Union was 100% behind the Union cause, and everyone south was fully supportive of the Confederacy. And that's just not the case. Just like today we think in red states and blue states, when really they're all purple. Same thing was similarly during the Civil War era. There were Unionists and Union spies in the Confederate capital of Richmond, but there were Southern sympathizers and Confederate spies in Washington, D.C. So, sure, a lot of people did leave, but you have to remember, too, especially, you know, in the case of Elizabeth Van Loo, but many others, that was their home. Their families had been there for generations. They loved their city. They loved their state. And in Elizabeth's case in particular, she was very caught off guard when Virginia seceded. up until the very last minute, she did not think it was going to happen. She always saw that Virginia, although it was a slaveholding state, she always thought that it had more in common with the states of the North, the more industrial states, and because of their commerce that went on so freely with the North. And she assumed that, like some of the other important border states, it would stay with the Union. And she thought in her some of her writings and her letters at the time, she thought her state had utterly gone mad. And it was devastating to her that when Virginia left the Union.
Yeah. How did you research this book, by the way? I mean, you've got a lot of the material, that the information in there is very accurate. I take it.
I try. I do my very best to make it as accurate as possible, even though it is a work of fiction. Well, I always start with the Wisconsin Historical Society whenever I need those kind of secondary resources and research material, because their archive is just absolutely fantastic. I've told my husband that we can never leave Wisconsin because I can't be more than 10 miles away from the Wisconsin Historical Society archives. But then it was also very important for me to visit Richmond and to get a sense of the city and to speak to experts and to look at the archives that they have there as well and try to get a sense of what the city would have been like when Elizabeth Van Loo lived there. Now, unfortunately, her mansion has been torn down since then, and Libby Prison is also no more. But it was still very valuable for me to be able to walk the streets and talk to experts. I read a lot of memoirs at the time, memoirs written by residents of Richmond during the war, to get their take on events and to be able to compare what one eyewitness said compared to someone else. And then a lot of prisoners from Libby Prison, when they were released, whether during the war, if they managed to get some kind of prisoner exchange, mm-hmm. or if they escaped, or if their account was not known until years later, being able to read their accounts of what it was like to be in Libby Prison or on Belle Isle was very important.
What was it like?
Pretty horrendous, as you can imagine. We know I think of one of the most famous or infamous prisons was Andersonville.
Yeah.
Well, one of the commandants of Andersonville started out being in charge of Richmond's prisons, and he was in charge of Libby Prison before he was transferred to Andersonville after it was constructed. And of course, northern prisons for the Confederates were pretty awful as well, but Libby was mostly for officers, and it was a series of converted warehouses, so you had people making their beds alongside old tobacco presses. There was a place in Libby Prison which was named Rat Hell because it was full of rats. They were very crowded, swelteringly hot in summer, bitterly cold in winter. If the prisoners went too close to the windows to try to gasp a breath of air, there was something called sporting for Yankees. If you got too close to the windows, you could be shot at and killed. But conditions on Belle Isle out in the river were even worse. That was where a lot of the enlisted men were kept. They had very flimsy tents. Death from starvation, exposure to the elements and disease were extraordinarily high. And Elizabeth was not allowed as much contact with the prisoners on Belle Isle, and so they unfortunately were not able to benefit from her gifts of food and blankets and clothing and books that she was able to take into Libby and some of the other prisons. So the conditions were very terrible, as you can imagine.
And yet she was able to gather information and be really good at it, as you pointed out earlier, getting information to our intelligence to the authorities, and really some ingenious methods.
That's right. And she managed to get people that she trusted placed into occupations. Like, she was able to get it was a known Union loyalist to her and not to the Confederacy, or he wouldn't have gotten the job. She managed to get one of her contacts placed into an important position of authority at Libby Prison. So he was able to smuggle money in, smuggle food in, and information out. But of course, he had to play the role of being an ardent Confederate warden. And he played this role to the hilt so well that when Libby Prison finally, when Richmond fell, he had to flee for Elizabeth of Anlieu's house because the prisoners, not knowing that he was really on their side, were going to string him up. She managed to bribe clerks who worked at some of the Confederate offices to smuggle her very important information. And she got a lot of very good military intelligence from the prisoners themselves, because when they were marched into Richmond or brought by the trainload and then put into the prison, they were able to come with the information fresh from the battlefield. They were able to see Richmond's defenses as they were brought in, and they got that information to Elizabeth, and Elizabeth was able to carry that out through her network of spies and employees. She was able to carry that past the pickets, the guards surrounding Richmond, and eventually get that information on its way north.
And using books and pinpricks and letters and...
She used,
eggs
that's
and...
right, she used all manners of ways to smuggle this out. And she also employed the services of a lot of her African-American servants. Now, of course, the word servant was used euphemistically for slave. And unfortunately, that has, it. They were, a lot of the times, slaves of the Vanloo household. Elizabeth and her mother wanted to release their slaves. They did not like being slave owners, but unfortunately, before Elizabeth's father died, he left his will so legally entangled that they were legally forbidden to grant the slaves their freedom. Now, if they bought a slave later and then just released him or her right away, and all that, they could get away with. But the slaves that Elizabeth's mother had inherited, she was unable to free. So they did the best they could. They would pay them wages and let them leave outside of the household if they wanted to. They just had to make sure they came back regularly to get their pass signed so that they didn't get arrested for being at large. But some of the servants would be sent on an errand out into the countryside, and they might carry coded messages hidden within a hollowed out egg placed within a basket of other eggs. Or the men would wear very thick-soled shoes. They would wear one pair of shoes out with messages hidden in the soles, and they'd wear another pair with other information back across the picket lines. And since the servants were on the business of their mistress and they had the pass, they were usually allowed through fairly without too much harassment.
Yeah. Quite a few questions. Shelley from Michigan, he has sent an email in. And says, the first time I remember hearing or reading about Elizabeth Vanloo was in the previous Elm Creek novel, The Union Quilters. And so she's just looking forward to visiting the bookstore tomorrow.
Oh, good. Well, thank you, Shelley.
Go ahead.
Well, that was the very book I was talking about when I was researching. And that's how so many of my books are inspired. I'll be writing another story and I'll come across some fascinating incident from American history or some incredibly intriguing person. And I'll just keep that idea in the back of my head until it really has time to germinate and become a novel. But Elizabeth Vanloo appears only briefly in The Union Quilters, but ever since writing that book, I've been wanting to tell the story that's coming out tomorrow.
And that's a great book, too. I love that book, too. So that's three Civil War books, right?
Well, and then I've written some antebellum novels, too, talking about the Underground Railroad. So even when I was writing the Elm Creek Quilt series, my love of American history surely did come through, and I brought it in whenever I could. So I have been writing historical fiction kind of all along.
You can join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. Have you read any of Jennifer's work? Love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Don from DePere emailed, and by the way, the email address is talk@wpr.org. He said, I'm not really a Civil War aficionado, and I haven't read any of Jennifer's books, but I always want to find a good book to read. Other than what I learned of the Civil War in high school, which was a long time ago, will I
find... For us all.
Yeah, for us all, believe me. Will I still find this book an interesting read?
Oh. Well, I'm not exactly an impartial source, but I would say I think you will. I think if you give it a try, now, of course, if you're going to write, you know, a term paper or something, you should rely on history and historical scholarship. But if you want a dose of history in a more entertaining fashion, then historical fiction's not a bad way to go. And I really do my very best to get the facts accurate. Now, that doesn't mean I'm infallible. I'm sure I've made mistakes along the way, but I don't fudge the dates. You know, I don't introduce a technological marvel that really wouldn't come along until 10 years later, unless it's by error. It's certainly not by design. So I find history fascinating because of the storytelling elements of it. And I do try to pass along that the excitement that I find with his historical stories within my own novels. So I say give it a try. And then you can let me know what you think.
I really would agree. Don, I think you're going to really enjoy the book. You're going to learn a little bit about history, but it's also really entertaining. And as I said earlier, it's a real nail biter. With some information, you'll learn a lot about what went on during the Civil War time. But, of course, the conversations that are there are, for the most part, probably thought up.
Well, that's true. Sometimes if a character has written something in a letter or in a memoir, I might take that and try to incorporate it into dialogue just to give a real sense for what the character might have said. But yes, a lot of imagination has to go into it. When you're writing historical fiction, I draw upon newspaper accounts, memoirs, as I mentioned, and all of the historical evidence that I can find, but that will only take me so far. And that's where the novelist's art has to come in, imagining, well, if these are the facts as stated in this newspaper account, how would Elizabeth have felt? How might she have felt in that situation? And then I do have to imagine what it would have been like for a woman in her situation facing these circumstances. And it was especially interesting for me to really try to get a sense of what was going on in the Confederate capital during the Civil War, because they were under siege for a lot of the war. What were the politics like? What was it like for just an ordinary citizen, whether it would be someone like Elizabeth, who felt very out of touch with what was going on in her community because her loyalties were elsewhere, but also for ordinary citizens, when food supplies started running low, when the death tolls were climbing ever higher, what would it have been like? And so for me, that's part of the joy of writing historical fiction, is really trying to delve into these historical documents, but then going where imagination will lead.
Yeah. Sounds like fun.
Well, I think it's a lot of fun. And I hope that readers will find the books fun, too. And they'll get that same sort of excitement in reading as I find in the discovery in my research.
Mm-hmm. You know, in some of the research, I think Elizabeth was misportrayed. Would that be the right? There was some talk about you never used, what was it, Crazy Bet?
Crazy Bet. But, you know, that's true. She is often referred to as Crazy Bet, and it all comes to one magazine article. That's where it all began. When I started my research, I thought I would be writing about Crazy Bet, the woman from Richmond who pretended to be mentally impaired in order to throw off suspicion. The myth was that she would wear funny clothes and she would kind of tilt her head to the side and kind of talk to herself in a sing-song voice so that people would dismiss her as inconsequential. But the more research I did into primary sources, I could not find that. I could not find that in the contemporary accounts, and it certainly wasn't in anything that she wrote. And then it all came back to one article. She was interviewed. Well, an article was written about her that focused on a lot of the observations of one person who met her when she was quite elderly, when health and when her health had deteriorated, and when heartbreak and losing loved ones and poverty and being ostracized by the Richmond community, who never forgave her for what she did for the Union during the war, when all of those burdens had taken their toll. And she was not the same woman she was in her 40s when she was taking all these risks and being so brave. And so that is that one article written so many years later portrayed her as someone who pretended to be mentally disabled or not quite sane in order to trick people. And that just, as you know, kind of more dramatic stories do, that really took hold. And so almost every book that has been written about her since refers to her as Crazy Bette. But if you go back to the primary sources, she's never described in that way. After she was named postmaster of Richmond, she was awarded that by President Grant, mm-hmm. in thanks for her wartime service. There were a lot of people who wanted to discredit her. There were a lot of people who wanted to see a man in that job and not such a progressive person in that job. She gave jobs to women. She gave jobs to African Americans. And that didn't sit well with people. So during a lot of her tenure as postmaster, people wanted to discredit her and smear campaigns were begun. Mm. If Elizabeth Van Loo had been demonstrating mental impairment, feigned or real, during the Civil War, that would have come out because people were using whatever they could find to discredit her. And no one ever mentions anything of that sort. So it seems highly unlikely that the myth is true. And unfortunately, it takes away a lot of what of a lot of her very real skill. She was clever. She was courageous. She knew how to charm people. She knew when to place an appropriate bribe. And she was very intelligent. And to say that everyone dismissed her because they thought she was a doddering spinster discredits her. She fooled people because she was very smart and very savvy.
And I think you refer in the book to her, the whole business of her being a spinster, as having a love at one point who...
Unfortunately, we're not sure who that person was.
But there was?
Well, according to an account left by her niece, and also an account left by a dear friend, she had experienced heartbreak. And we're just left to imagine what that could have been. You know, it's maybe not something you talk about to your contemporary readers. Now, maybe they didn't want that out when, you know, in the 1800s. But to us in the 21st century, it would have been nice if someone had left an account for us. So whether she fell in love and it wasn't reciprocated, whether she, you know, we don't really know. So that's where I had to bring in fiction. So I have her losing a love at an early age. But, you know, what the real story behind the heartbreak that she experienced, we don't really know. It hasn't been discovered yet. Perhaps sometime in the future I'll find out what it really was. But I don't really know.
Well, she did a wonderful job, by the way. You mentioned her work with the Postal Service.
Yes. She was
one of the best.
She was pretty fantastic. And General Grant awarded her that as thanks for her wartime service, and also because she had almost bankrupted herself dispensing funds for the Union cause throughout the war, whether it was placing bribes, buying supplies, or paying people who were loyal to get them to stay loyal so that they didn't turn against the Union. So he awarded her this job, and she was very progressive. She wanted to be called postmaster, not postmistress, because she understood that there would be a little less authority if she took the mistress title. She probably would not be too happy that I call her the spy mistress in the title of my book here. Mm. But perhaps she'll forgive me, because I did at least try to debunk the Crazy Bette myth. She modernized the post office. She increased the distribution of letters. Throughout Richmond, she made it set up so that there were post boxes throughout the city. She was very forward-thinking in her hiring practices. She wrote a manual using her initials. She didn't go by Elizabeth. She went by E.L. Van Loo. She wrote a manual that was praised and used as the standard across the country.
Yeah.
And General Grant, when he was elected to his second term, he reinstated her despite outcry from local people who wanted her job for themselves. And it was so she had to fight to keep that job. Eventually, she did lose it. A lot of Union loyalists ended up getting swept out of office when a new administration came in after Grant. But while she was in office, she was very, very productive and really modernized the Richmond Post Office.
Good for Grant.
Good for him.
He didn't do. He didn't always do what we might consider the right thing,
no,
but he did.
He did right by Elizabeth Van Loo for as long as he could.
Yeah, you've got sightings. We were talking about this earlier, but what's next for you now?
I'll be at Barnes & Noble in Westtown Mall in Madison tomorrow night at 7 p.m. And then next week on Tuesday, I'll be in Baraboo doing an event sponsored by the Baraboo Public Library at the Ringling Theater. And that, too, will be at 7. And then on Thursday, I think it's the 10th. We're going to say the 10th. It is Thursday. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be returning to one of my very favorite independent bookstores, Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. So I'm looking forward to all those visits.
And what's next?
Well, I have another book coming out in January.
Wow.
Yes, another Civil War book, and it'll be coming out January 14th. And this book is another one that was inspired by a previous novel. It's called Mrs. Lincoln's Rival, and it focuses on Kate Chase, who appeared in Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker.
Yes.
She was Mary Lincoln's social rival during the Civil War, the daughter of Salmon P. Chase, who was Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury,
mm-hmm.
and went on to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And she was quite a fascinating political figure during the Civil War, and in fact before and after as well, as she did all that she could to try to help her father achieve his lifelong ambition of becoming president.
Well, so we'll be seeing you in January then.
I certainly hope so.
Jennifer, you have a wonderful book. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Jennifer Cheverini is the author of many books. Her latest is titled The Spy Mistress. Wonderful book about Elizabeth Van Loo, who was posthumously inducted into the Military Intelligence Hall of Fame for the work that she did for the Union during the Civil War. It's a great story, a fascinating read, and I'm really happy that she was able to come by and talk with us about it today. And everybody talks about the weather. What's the old saying? Everybody talks about the weather. Nobody does anything about it. Well, a couple guys that try to do something about it are coming up next year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.